You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, listeners, it's that time of year again, and I'm going to ask a favor of you if you enjoy Kick-Ass News and want to keep us going. In order to support our show, we'll need the help of some great advertisers. And in order to find great advertisers, we'll need to learn a little bit more about you. So please, go to podsurvey.com/kick and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you a little better. That way, we can show advertisers just how great our listeners are. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you can choose to enter for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's podsurvey, podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for your help, and thanks for listening. It's happened to all of us. Right before an important presentation, the printer runs out of ink. Brother Ink Vestment Tank Printers help put a stop to this and can literally change the way you ink. With your choice of up to 1 or 2 years of ink included in box, Ink Vestment Tank helps eliminate the expense and hassle of frequently buying and replacing ink cartridges. Learn more at changethewayyouink.com. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the creation of Top Gun, the elite Navy fighter jet school made famous by Tom Cruise in the movie of the same name. And now the founder of the program and the man known as the godfather of Top Gun, Captain Dan Pederson, separates fact from fiction and shares the remarkable inside story of how he and 8 other risk-takers revolutionized the art of aerial combat in a new book titled Top Gun, An American Story. And today, Captain Pederson joins me on the podcast to recall entering the Navy at a time when aerial combat training was all but banned and how he and his fellow pilots learned their skills at a secret fight club in the sky off the coast of San Diego. He discusses how the pilot losses he witnessed in the Vietnam War directly led to the formation of the Top Gun program, how he and the other original 9 bros, as they're called, got it up and running in just a matter of weeks with little or no funding, and what they looked for in new recruits. He talks about getting to train against real Russian MiG fighter jets at the most secretive place in America, the mental and physical stamina required to perform the kind of aerial acrobatics taught at Top Gun, and the toll that it can take on a pilot's personal life. Plus, he shares what the famous movie gets wrong, he reveals the absolute worst weather to fly in, and he offers a few choice words about the Pentagon's current reliance on the costly F-35 fighter jet. Coming up with Captain Dan Pederson in just a moment. Dan Pederson entered the U.S. Navy in 1953 as an enlisted mechanic. He served in combat during the Vietnam War with 2 flying cruises on the USS Hancock and 2 on the USS Enterprise. He's known as the godfather of Top Gun, having been the senior officer in the group of 9 men who formed the Navy's legendary graduate fighter jet program at Naval Air Station Miramar in March 1969. Later, he commanded the super aircraft carrier USS Ranger, and he ultimately retired as a captain, having accumulated 6,100 flight hours, 1,005 carrier landings, and flying 39 types of aircraft. Now he writes about his experience in a new memoir titled Top Gun, An American Story. Captain Pedersen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, Captain Pedersen, this year is the 50th anniversary of the Top Gun program. Why is it taking you so long to finally tell the story behind this fabled institution?
Oh, you know, all naval aviators are humble, right? You believe that?
Yeah, certainly not based on what we see in the movies.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that was good entertainment. But to get to your answer, about 18 months ago, we knew the 50th was coming up. There's still seven of the original bros, as we call each other, alive. And we are trying to plan some things for the 50th anniversary celebration. And a book came up, being the original Top Gun 1, they said, you got to write the book. So here we go.
Yeah.
That was how it started, Ben.
You joined the Navy in the 1950s, which was kind of a strange time for fighter pilots. We've all seen the footage of dogfights in World War II, but in the years following World War II and before you formed Top Gun, training in that kind of aerial combat was all but banned in the military. What was their reason for this?
It's expensive, dangerous, and industry, almost historically in this country, always designs the airplanes and weapons that guys like myself have to go out and fight with. And so it was the right time to go back and study a little history and learn to dogfight again like the great guys did in World War II.
Yeah. And in fact, you talk about having to learn your skills at a secret fight club for Navy pilots off the coast of San Diego. How did you find out about this secret society, and what was the protocol if you wanted to go up against another pilot?
You know, it was just like just not a free-for-all because it was done safely. But there were enough guys still around who didn't like the tactics we were being forced to fly. True aviators, I call them, and they wanted to fly like the World War II guys did. And the word spread quietly, usually at the bar. And on Friday afternoon, we'd go out there and there'd be cats and dogs, essentially, of different kinds of airplanes. And they'd just get it on and practice their skills. And didn't brag about it, didn't say much, because you didn't want to get hung out to dry by some senior. That's the truth.
And it must have been an interesting time to do that, because when they were dogfighting in World War II, those were very different types of planes than the kind of jets that you guys were flying at that time. Yeah. It must have been quite an adjustment to learn how to do that sort of stuff in these new jets.
Scale maneuvers out geometrically is what you really do. Mm-hmm. Jets go faster. They operate in a bigger realm, if you will, or an egg. And we just took the strength of the F-4 Phantom and redesigned them beyond what the builder had done with them, and it worked.
Yeah.
And I had a great mentor in 3rd Living Ace, 2nd World War, Gene Valencia, who was in the first fighter squadron I was ever in, and he mentored myself and a couple guys. And so it was instinctive in this, after being around him, mm-hmm. that we really learned to dogfight.
You were then deployed to Yankee Station off the coast of Vietnam just as the Vietnam War was ramping up. And you saw firsthand how unprepared American pilots were for the kind of fight that the North Vietnamese were throwing at them. What kind of problems were you seeing over there?
Well, the biggest problem, and it still exists today out in Afghanistan, the government manages the rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this country, every once in a while, we get a leader who wants to win. And when you go in and do the kind of work we do with those airplanes, don't send anybody unless you intend to win.
Yeah.
And over in Vietnam during that cruise you're talking about, it's in the book in detail, but we weren't allowed to win. We had to the equipment didn't work quite the way it was designed to. The war wasn't that way. And the rules engagement tied our hands.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. So too much bureaucracy, huh? Too much red tape?
Well, you know, for some reason, the politicians think they can fight better than we can. And, you know, I'd love to have had a couple of them in the back seat.
Yeah.
I'd take Robert McNamara and put him in the back seat of Phantom and go fly a combat mission and bring him back aboard. He and I could land aboard the boat at night on a black night with weather.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I'll bet you'd have to wash down that back seat afterwards.
Yeah.
And I think you say that those early lessons in Vietnam directly led to a reassessment of America's fighter jet strategy and the formation of Top Gun. What kind of changes did that mandate call for?
Two things. Frank Ault, the skipper of Coral Sea, wrote an unsolicited report on why we were doing so poorly out there. Kill ratio was 2-1.
Wow.
Two of us, or two of them for every one of us, would be shot down. And he prescribed that we start a graduate school, really a get-well program. Minimum amount of time, 90 days, come up with a new curriculum, correct the mistakes that we were making out there, and identify those, and the weapons reliability of what we were carrying on the airplane. They didn't work very well. Mm-hmm. So our weapons were weak. Our tactics were weak, and the beautiful Phantom, which was a great airplane once we got it trained, if you will, didn't come with a gun from the manufacturer. And a gun, the Gatling gun, is still a weapon of choice for anybody who flies in combat.
Really? That surprises me. Why is that?
Oh, it make you think. Have you seen the pictures and the videos of one of those Gatling guns that shoot 6,000 rounds a minute? If somebody's got one of those and he's about to get on your tail, you are going to sweat and you're going to do something good.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Dan, you kind of lucked out because you just happened to be the guy who was around when this mandate came down and you got put in charge of the whole program, huh?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Big question mark at the time, you know.
Yeah. In those early days, did anyone think Top Gun might become the institution that it is today, perhaps even including yourself?
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, we found the sense of urgency in the fact that we had all just come back from combat, and we knew we were going again. The war was dragging on, and we had buried a lot of guys, a lot of great American, and we were tired of it. And the airlines were hiring, and there are a lot of question marks, you know. And the wives were pushing hard for us to get out, and being patriotic, most of the guys that fly for a living are truly Americans, and we stayed in, and we changed it.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned you only had, I think, 3 months to get it up and running and little to no funding. And needless to say, I won't give anything away, but you guys kind of came up with equipment in the classroom and everything by hook or by crook, however you needed to.
Well,
they were very resourceful, let's say that.
Yeah, one of my guys, probably one of my best friends of the original eight in life's work, he would have been convicted as a felon, you know. I mean, he stole a building. He traded the building, and he got a guy with a big crane to move this 40-foot long by 20-foot wide building on a Saturday. He moved it down by the hangar where all the reasonable people operated out of. And it cost us a case of scotch.
Yeah, that's a pretty good deal.
So, and then by Monday morning, somehow, he had gotten hold of safes to keep the classified stuff in, desks, chairs, enough to equip it. And about 4 days later, we were up and operating.
Wow.
By hook or by crook.
Yeah. Well, the entire graduate training staff consisted of yourself and just eight other pilots and experts who came to be known as the original Nine Bros. Can you tell us a little about that original team?
Well, as I said, every one of them had been to combat at least twice. Mm-hmm. And they're all, I probably had two of them, three of them, that were the best in the world at the time. And And there's a guy named Mel Holmes, an Oregon basketball player, great naval aviator. His magic was he became one with the airplane when he strapped it on. He lived to fly. And almost every one of them were the same breed of cat. And, you know, there's no greater happiness for a naval aviator unless he gets to fly 40 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours a month. And it's usually about an hour at a click.
Yeah, you actually describe working and training at Top Gun as sort of this warrior monk-like existence, which kind of goes against what we've seen in the movies. What kind of toll does that take on your personal life?
You can't leave for 8 months every year or every other year or leave for I did. I left for a year once. Come back and your kids don't know you.
Yeah.
And that's the price. I wish the American public would realize what commitment. Right now today, off of Afghanistan, the guys are down in the Persian Gulf or the Indian Ocean. The guys are flying all the way up into Afghanistan to support the people fighting the ground war up there. Right now today, they're out there on the aircraft carrier, and they've been there for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's a heck of a sacrifice you guys make.
Yeah.
I'm curious, where did the name Top Gun come from?
I get asked that a lot. And it just popped in my head one day. There had been a Top Gun Navy gunnery school down in Fowler in El Centro, California, but it had been disbanded a couple of years before. So, the carrier I ultimately commanded and a few years later was called Top Gun of the Pacific Fleet. That was Ranger. So I thought, man, we got to have a nickname. Can't run around all day and step on your tongue saying Navy Fighter Weapons School, you know? And so we all sat at the bar one night and agreed on Top Gun.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about the bureaucracy and the red tape you had to deal with. I want to say when you formed Top Gun, your commanding officer told you something like, don't lose any planes and don't get anyone killed. Now, to me, that sounds like kind of a paradox right there, because here you are, you're tasked with training elite fighter pilots. You have to build risk into that process to simulate a real dogfight, or else you're going to end up sending them into combat unprepared, right?
Yeah, you have a great understanding of what we're talking about. And, that's the only guidance I got. I didn't get any paperwork. I didn't get any written instructions, no warranties, you know. Here's nine young guys. I was 32 years old. The youngest one was a guy called Condor, and he was 22. And I never had to ask permission for anything I did.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, the Navy supported us. We borrowed airplanes. We wrote the curriculum. The curriculum was never actually reviewed until several classes after we started teaching it. And it was so well received by the students who were going back to the fleet. And these guys weren't beginners either. They were really good to start with. But we put the icing on the cake, graduate level, changed the tactics in the F4, and they worked. Mm-hmm. And and the kill ratio, as I said, I think I told you already, it went from 2 to 1. By the end of the war, the time Top Gun had been really involved, it was 24 to 1. Now, who's gonna disagree or disapprove of that?
Yeah.
And so they pretty much everybody jumped on the bandwagon, and at the end of the war, everybody was glad it was over. It was a miserable war. Never fight a war you don't intend to win.
Yeah.
And that was the case. I talk about it extensively in a book. If you're going to put your children in harm's way, you better intend to win and do everything to win in the shortest amount of time.
Yeah.
And we still don't do that. Too much diplomacy, too much policy.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Top Gun was both born out of the Vietnam War in the early days and later had a significant impact on how successful those aerial missions were at the end of the war. Do you ever wonder if the war might have ended differently if it hadn't been for the military's micromanagement and all the resulting pilot losses you guys had early on?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure I got the energy to write another book, but but the geopolitics of how we fight, we never truly study the culture we're up against mm-hmm. or the country's history. We're just not good students of history as a country.
Yeah.
And I think we could do that. And myself and a lot of guys I know have been quoted as saying, we could have won the Vietnam War in 6 months, dropped them to their knees, and they would have given in. Had we been turned loose, you know, take the leash off mm-hmm. and let us do what we're professionally good at. But that McNamara wouldn't do that, and
yeah.
neither would LBJ.
And what kind of things did you look for in the pilots that you recruited to Top Gun?
I looked at their experience in the air. Everybody in naval aviation ends up with a reputation within the system. The guys are known for strength, weakness.
Mm-hmm.
They got to be able to teach. My guys had to be able to teach at a graduate level and teach some very fine students and get them to believe how to do it differently than we had been taught for years. So...
Yeah,
these guys are just, sometimes I wonder how it all came together. And that's not just me. That's the original bros. We've talked about it. You know, the standards were high. The guys were there. They excelled. And we won.
Yeah.
And maybe there was some force bigger than I that quietly helped us along. It wasn't just me. Wasn't just any of the eight, although I needed every one of them.
Yeah, and you mentioned a moment ago something that I don't think a lot of people realize about Top Gun is you're not specifically training pilots to go into combat. You're training pilots who will then go and teach other pilots, go back to their home base and pass that forward. And it kind of, in theory, has a multiplier effect. Huh?
Right on. Absolutely. That was the whole purpose.
Yeah.
When you're losing the war and you got all the carriers out there, you got to get a force multiplier,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I think they only gave me 90 days to get rolling, and it worked.
Yeah.
And now all these years later, you know, the naval aviation, naval air arm on all our carriers, they're about as good as they're going to get,
mm-hmm.
except that we probably need some new, simpler airplanes.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I wish we had the F-18 or yeah. the F-14 Tomcats again. But
in the last chapter, you have a few choice things to say about the military's modern-day fighter procurement and doctrine, and
yeah.
particularly the military's apparent reliance on the F-35 fighter jet. What don't you like about the F-35?
Number one, it took 26 years to develop a program.
Mm-hmm.
They spent over $1 trillion on it already. And there are a few of them out there. The Marines have got a squadron or two, and Israel's got them. Everybody's trying to make them work. They're very sophisticated. And we spent $1 trillion developing it, 26 years, and we still don't have a Navy fully operational that everything works on the airplane. And it's so sophisticated and so expensive. Each airplane is worth $300 million.
Wow. Whew.
Yeah.
Talk about and not I wanting to lose a plane.
No, listen, you got 10 beautiful nuclear aircraft carriers. You're not going to be able as a country to buy enough F-35s in order to put 60, 80 of them on an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
They'll go, I wish they'd build about 3,000 small ones. And the biggest hurt from that program is the pilots don't have enough to fly. They don't have enough flight time.
Oh,
cost
really?
Per flight hour, including gas and spare parts and everything, is exorbitant. So
yeah.
Anyhow. Now you've heard my sermon for the day.
Well, I think there are some people who should probably listen to you, given your experience. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Captain Dan Pedersen when we come back in just a moment. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment and get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then, simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/kick. One more time, betterhelp.com/kick. And now, back to the show. What was the most important lesson that you tried to instill in your pilots at Top Gun?
Oh, you take care of each other. You know, that's something, you know, the movie didn't do a very good job of. They had them in open competition. The guys never, even today, are not that way. It's the greatest fraternity or brotherhood you could ever. When you take off, you ever watch them on videos and TV? They always take off in pairs. Your life is dependent on a guy on your wing. And his life is dependent on you, and the rest of the guys in the squadron at a given point in time are all dependent on each other. Mm-hmm. And you're dealing in human life every single damn day, whether you're in combat or whether you're just flying training missions.
I have to ask then, what other things did the movie get wrong? How does Top Gun of Tom Cruise and Val Kilmer differ from the real thing?
You know, I'm not a film critic, but the flying in the movie was real. They were done by Top Gun pilots with cameramen or something. Flying was very real. I love the music of it. But the portrayal of Maverick and Iceman and Hollywood and all the, you know, backbiting, if you will, and jealousy and competition, that never existed. You know, you have a living obligation when you fly for the Navy to take it. There's nothing worse than losing your wingman.
Yeah.
Particularly if he's a young one.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened. That's the real world.
Yeah. And, how about all the skirt chasing?
Oh, it helped enlistments. The Navy had applications 300% more than they needed.
Oh, really?
Applications of flight training. Yeah.
Did you guys have any input in the movie as consultants or anything?
Oh, one of the guys, Pete Pettigrew, call sign Viper, he was the advisor to the movie, and he was a great guy, and he fought for realism and so forth. Mm-hmm. He's the guy that was standing at the bar with Kelly McGillis when they played that famous song.
Oh, yeah. You've lost that love and feeling, is that right?
Yeah, they were going to sing to her, and then he follows her into the ladies' room, and that was Pete, the big, good-looking guy by Kelly in the movie. But I don't say anything bad about the movie, really.
How about the sequel coming up next year? Do you guys have any involvement with that?
The Navy, current Navy, I'm retired, but the current Navy has a couple fleet guys, one Top Gunner being the advisor on it, and I'm not privy to why it was delayed. Probably disagreements. Hollywood's different, and they're the ones that are funding it. And they want to fly, and the only thing we always defend, and even through the network of guys that are, you know, 50 years of following the school. When you finish, you love it.
Yeah.
And you're part of it forever. And
sounds like it.
They make their opinions known in most cases.
Yeah, it sounds like you still keep in touch with the original nine bros. Are they all alive? Or I think most of them are still around, right?
No. 7 and 9, cancer got to him.
Oh, gosh.
And, pardon me. And, in fact, I'm going up there when I leave New York City here in a couple of days. I'm going back up Top Gun, have a little board meeting with everybody, see how the boys are doing.
Well, there are more than a few scenes in this book that could be straight out of a movie, and I'm thinking of one in particular where you finally get to go up against your white whale, the Russian MiG fighter jet. You always wanted to go head-to-head against one, and you end up doing so finally at a surprising place in the Nevada desert that you guys called Dreamland. But that location is probably better known to my listeners by what name?
Dreamland, Area 51. It was home to some MiGs that we had gotten our hands on. And I actually went up there for a week, and Mel Holmes and I went up, and we flew the MiGs. So that way we validated the tactics, the new tactics for the Phantom we came up with. We flew them. Mm-hmm. And then the graduating class, the first class we graduated with the new tactics and so forth. We launched out of Miramar. We really didn't tell them. We said we're going out and we're going to do something surprising, and we're going to get it on. You know, we're going to get it on, all of us. So we went out of California up in Nevada and rolled over some desolate country, and pretty soon somebody says, "Geez, there's MiGs on us." I look out, and there's two MiGs jumped my students. And that got a real reaction.
Yeah. And wasn't there a 3-star general over at Area 51 in charge of the MiGs who told you guys that you weren't supposed to use the MiGs in any dogfights? You didn't obey those orders, like, did you?
It's like rules of engagement in war. Yeah. There's always somebody.
Sure.
Pours a little.
How were you
able? A little cold water on it. Cold water on it. And,
how were you able to get around that?
You just do what you got to do because it's, you know, in a month and a half, those kids were going to be back out in Vietnam getting shot at. And somebody in the cooperation we had in Area 51 was actually very good.
Really?
It was a matter of don't tell me. I really don't want to
know. Yeah. What was it like to finally get your dream of going up against a MiG?
You know, the MiGs are simple.
Really?
They're very, very reliable. We had one airplane we flew 159 times and just put tires, checked the hydraulics, and put fuel in them. And they were ultra-reliable. Hmm. And really good little airplane, turn on a dime.
Yeah.
I'd like to have 3,000. We have one called the F-5. I'd like to see them upgrade the F-5 a little bit. We ought to be able to buy them for about $12,000 or $12 million a piece instead of $300 million.
Yeah,
and then we'd be able to get some flight time. Right now, the reason the guys are getting out and they're not getting any flight time.
Mm-hmm.
We had 8 years of sequester. You know what I mean by this sequester?
Right.
Yeah. Well, the money wasn't given to them to buy the fuel, and the boys don't get the flight time.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, in the profession I come out of, if you don't fly 40 hours a month, you're not going to be very good, and you're going to get your butt handed to you over in combat if you go.
Yeah, fancy jet that you don't know how to fly isn't much good, is it?
Well, that's right. And the other thing is, when I went on later in life, I ended up skippering the beautiful Big Ranger and USS Ranger. I had a crew of probably on a given day 5,200, 5,400 on board. They come and they go. But what do you think the average age of that crew was?
25, 22?
How about 19 and a half?
Oh, wow.
Now, that's not to say a lot of them were. Some of them were chiefs, first-class petty officers, second-class petty officers, who were maintainers of the airplanes and were pretty good, really good at it. But we were constantly training the young ones.
Mm-hmm.
And used to call it boys camp, you know.
Wow.
It's just, yeah. You never get finished training because they come and they go. And now you're talking about taking a $300 million airplane and letting the 19-year-olds learn how to maintain it. They're doing pretty well with it, with contract maintenance done by some industry group. But,
yeah.
And not enough of them, and they don't get enough flight time. Yeah. So, anyhow.
And when you commanded the USS Ranger off the coast of Vietnam, you were there for the fall of South Vietnam, and apparently you aided in the rescue of many Vietnamese boat people who were escaping the communists. How heart-wrenching was that experience?
It's just, I picked up 140 of them one day in the South China Sea. I've been out for just about 6 months in the Indian Ocean and was headed to the Philippines and then home. And one Sunday morning, I come across I had two A6 aircraft in the air just to stretch their legs and exercise the airplanes. And they found this little boat. The boat was about 25, 28 feet long, and had 140 people on it. And they'd had five of them die. They had been at sea for 3 weeks. Anyhow, long story short, rescued them and took them to the Philippines, and they integrated into, some of them came to America. Mm-hmm. 15 years later, I get a call from a young guy going to college. It's the youngest of a family of six that I rescued who remembered the number 61 on the Ranger and wanted to meet me and thank me.
No kidding.
And long story now, that family, all of them are college educated, very close personal friends of mine. I love those people. And the one who came to me, I met him on ABC on a Good Morning America, wanted us to meet and for the first time. So as a grown-up, and I went and spoke at his college graduation. I commissioned him in the Army as an officer, and right now he's a colonel in Japan in the U.S. Army.
That's incredible.
And doing, that's America.
Yeah, you must be very proud of him.
Yeah. Oh, I love him. They're great people.
Before we move on, I just have to ask, did you dogfight any UFOs when you were at Area 51?
No. You're not going to give me
no? Or you can't talk about it if you did.
A lot of magic things go on there at night, and for a reason, they're held very close. So Area 51, we were just lucky to get to fly there, and they learned a lot in very short order.
Whether you're fighting MiGs or UFOs, when you're performing the kind of maneuvers that are taught at Top Gun, I have to imagine the G-forces and the disorientation are pretty hard on a pilot. What level of physical and mental stamina does it take?
You know, we'd fly twice a day, and I'd go play racquetball with Steve Smith that's in the book.
Really?
He's a world-class racquetball player. And we'd do that to unwind and then go have a beer at the club. And we debrief the day's work, all the guys. And that's the routine. Worked them 7 days a week. But Sunday morning, we kind of went home, go home and try and make up with the family. And it was pretty important business.
Yeah, you mentioned going back and trying to make up with the family. And we already talked about how hard it is on a pilot's personal life. But according to the book, it sounds like it worked out all right for you in the end. Eventually, your love story had a happy ending. Do you want to tell us about that?
She's here in New York with me. That's my soulmate. Met her on her 14th birthday. Due to an error I made, she married her college football player friend. I didn't see her for 32 years. And then I had a valley in my life, and I just by the grace of God met her again, and she was alone and I was alone. That's 27 years ago, and I haven't looked back. Boy, have we had a good life together.
Well, you sound like you're both very happy.
God's been good to us. We live in the greatest country in the world, and I just wish everybody would end up being that happy as we are.
Well, Dan, I want to wind down by asking you about the state of Top Gun today. I have to wonder, with the military's increased reliance on unmanned drones, do you worry that fighter jets might be relegated to a minor role in combat strategy or even entering a new dark age similar to what you experienced when you first became a pilot back in the 50s?
You know, if we were left to the people involved in the aircraft and weapons procurement, we probably would get keep running costs up and be more and more sophisticated, because that's how you make money in that business. Mm-hmm. That isn't how you fight the war necessarily. And it's well intended, but it's run and staffed by people who don't have combat experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the quotes I use a lot when I'm doing speaking is, it only takes one bullet to get you down. One bullet in the right place will put you on the ground, hopefully. And all these modern bells and whistles they're putting in just drive the price up on new equipment, and it doesn't do a damn thing for reliability. Reliability, maintainability. Remembering you got 19-year-old kids on those aircraft carriers trying to maintain those very sophisticated airplanes. And that overloads a pilot, too, because when you really get into combat itself, it gets very busy, very dynamic. People shooting missiles at you, triple area guns, cannons from the ground, and then you throw a few MiGs in the mixture. I actually have been up on strike with 30 Navy airplanes, and had 15 missiles shot at us, and constant barrage of AAA, you know, you get out of that, you're lucky.
And, yeah.
You don't have time to look in the cockpit and work with all these whiz-bang things they're putting in the airplanes.
Yeah.
I go back to simplicity.
Really?
I am a big advocate. You give me a gun and a leading-edge gun sight, lead computing gun sight, and a gun and an airplane that'll turn that my country can afford for me to fly and train with, and I'll take on anybody in the world today.
Yeah.
Bring on their fifth generation fighters.
Yeah.
I'm not a bit afraid of it.
Yeah.
I'm 83.
Speaking of going up there in difficult conditions, what's the worst weather to fly in?
We went out in a blizzard, had to have two guys help us, one under each arm, put us in the cockpit. The airplanes were on the catapult, strapped down, chained down, so we didn't have to taxi on the icy deck of Enterprise.
Jeez.
And they shot us off. I couldn't even see the bow in the snow.
Oh, my God.
Shot the two of us off. And we went up for 2 hours, and I followed the skipper around in radar trail, locked on him and followed him around up there. Nothing's going to happen. You're not going to be able to do anything. And 2 hours later, they bring us back down. Well, skipper goes by, comes down, instrument approach to the carrier, and the landing signal officer says to him, "You sounded good when you went by me." He said, "You were perfect." And he said, "I couldn't see a thing." He said, "We never saw you either." And so he pulls up and goes around again, and I come down, and I don't see anything. And you know, you can run those big machines out of fuel doing that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It come around, and we're both on the same frequency, and I'm listening to him. He comes around for another approach, and being the kind of great, great leader he was, he decides he's going down with his lights on. This is at night. He goes down, and he finds the wake of the big carrier. You know, that's 60, 80 feet wide of churning white water, and it goes for a couple miles behind the ship. So he goes down, the belly lights off his airplane, lights the white. He lines up perfectly on that wake and stayed on the wake, and the LSOs told him to cut his engines. So he pulls his engines off, and boom, he lands and gets a wire. The next thing out of the guy's mouth is he calls me. He said, "Dale," he said, "go down as low as you can. Stay on the wake. Find the wake. Stay on the wake." And I did. I came around and essentially did about what he did. And I got a wire on that pass. And
That's pretty incredible.
I had no more fuel. I could not have done that again. And that's what we call pucker factor. So
I love it.
Yeah. But when it's over and you're having a hot cup of coffee down in the ready room, who cares, you know, just another day.
Oy, oy, oy. Well, real quickly before we go, I just have to ask, what's the best part of being up there in a fighter jet?
Oh, the beauty.
Mm-hmm.
The absolute beauty of flying. Most days at altitude, you know, I've been at 50,000 feet over California at night, and I could see every major city about Christmas time. Just absolute. That's me personally. I just love the beauty of flying.
Yeah.
And I was very comfortable doing it all my life.
Well, hopefully you'll inspire some more pilots with this great book. It's called Top Gun, An American Story. Captain Dan Pedersen, thanks so much for your service, and thanks for taking time to chat with me.
I hope it reaches a lot of kids in high school right now.
Absolutely.
And they study hard, get some grades and some courage, and try on naval aviation. It's really a man's business, and it's very, very satisfying. I loved it.
Thanks again to Captain Dan Pedersen for coming on the podcast. Get his book, Top Gun, An American Story, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.